Let's improve our financial literacy skills on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. New research shows America trails much of the world in financial literacy skills. And coming up, financial planner Kevin McKinley will explain what's being done in Wisconsin to improve our financial literacy here. And we will welcome your questions. Kevin will help improve your financial literacy, too. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Well, I understand despite an increase in efforts, American students aren't measuring up to the rest of the world in their financial literacy skills. What's going on?
Well, apparently not enough 15-year-olds are listening to On Your Money, Joy. I don't understand it. We try to keep it up, keep it hip with the kids, with the lingo and what they like to hear about, the rock and roll bumpers that we have, but it's not working. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, better known as the OECD, took a survey of 15-year-olds in 18 different countries and asked a bunch of story problem-type questions about invoices and stock prices and paychecks. And the results were the United States did not do very well. We were ninth out of 18, and several countries that you would expect, like Estonia and others, scored ahead of the United States. Now, even the administrators of the survey did admit that people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds did not do as well on the test as people from upper socioeconomic backgrounds, and people who were recent immigrants to the country did not do as well in their respective country as did not do as well either. So there were some, depending on who was taking the test for a specific country, there was probably some reasons that the United States didn't do as well. But there were still some questions that I actually had to stop and think about. We'll put the sample of the questions up at onyourmoney.com, but if you want to take the test, you can go there and see how well you did. Even though we're doing a lot for financial literacy, it still is something where every time a test like this or a survey like this comes out, it just seems that we're not making a lot of progress in terms of giving kids financial skills that they need in the future.
Yeah, so why do you think it's so difficult to teach financial skills?
Well, there's not enough time in the school day, and it often isn't made to be made a priority on the curriculum. People try to wedge this in, but there are still only so many hours in a day that teachers have to deal with this. And part of the problem, too, comes with this is financial skills, if you will, are not so much about information or education as the primary goal of success. It is much more about discipline, trying to get people to not borrow too much or borrow for the wrong reasons or pay too high of an interest rate, trying to get them to invest early for the long term rather than spending their first paychecks, and then trying to get them to spend a little less money than they are spending so that they can have some other money to pay off debt or to invest for the long term.
So do we know how we're doing in Wisconsin on these fronts?
Wisconsin is much better than the rest of the states in terms of promoting financial literacy, especially in younger people. We have the Money Smart Week in April, which typically has several hundred different courses all around the state, which are available and open to people of all ages and cover all different kinds of topics. And the Governor's Council on Financial Literacy, which was actually founded in 2000, and so we're in our 14th year of that. The Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions does a great job of promoting financial literacy, and as part of that, they've partnered with Edwards College to create the National Institute of Financial Education and Literacy. And what they do is teachers come from all over the Midwest and learn how to teach financial skills to their students. And since the year 2000, they've had 1,300 educators have come from 13 states, and they have three different sessions at Edgewood College in Madison. And I recently was honored to be asked to present to those educators, and I've done so for, I think, for the last probably 10 years or so.
And did they get to high marks?
They did do very well. They were very interested, even though it was a beautiful summer day and they were inside. They were very curious and had lots of good questions for me throughout the whole presentation.
And how can you share some of your material that you shared with them?
Sure. And as a father of a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, I'm starting to just see how difficult it is to impart some of these skills to otherwise supposedly gifted and talented children. But what I like to do for people who are trying to figure out where their money should be going is I created a presentation called Where Should Your Next Dollar Go? And give people a checklist so that they can decide what to do with their money as long as they have all the bases covered. So they would first have 6 months of expenses set aside. Second of all, they would have some money in a Roth IRA, maxing out their Roth IRA contributions every single year. And that can be combined, of course, with those 6 months of expenses, that they would be contributing enough to their at-work retirement plan at least to get the employer match, and then hopefully to get down below the 15% federal income tax bracket, that they were then accumulating enough savings aside for future expenses such as, you know, house repairs or having to buy a new car. And then finally, they paid off all of their unsecured debt and give people the freedom to know that if they are covering all of those bases, then they can actually start spending cash on vacations or clothes or electronics or whatever less practical items they might want to purchase.
Sounds good. I like the lesson plan. And let's ask if there's any 15-year-olds listening right now. let's see if any teenagers or young people are out there, and you can tell us. I don't know. If you have some sort of personal finance question or some sort of financial literacy issue that you'd like to ask Kevin about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Of course, you can also call in or email your question if you are a little older than a teenager, too. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and a loyal listener in Southeast Wisconsin writes, I listen to you every week and enjoy your sage advice mixed with dry humor. Okay. I was looking to boost the return on the money market funds at Vanguard and purchased $10,000 in a 5-year CD at 2.1%. When I tracked my new $10,000 investment at Vanguard, I was surprised to see it had lost value. I thought I was fairly financially savvy, but this definitely has me confused. How are CDs and retirement accounts different from plain vanilla CDs at a local bank?
Is dry good in a sense of humor?
I think it is.
Is it? Okay, good. That was a close one. Yeah, they are different, loyal listener in Southeast Wisconsin. They're called brokered CDs, and many larger investment firms like the Merrill Lynch's and Morgan Stanley's or whatever they're called now of the world offer these, and they're offered at places like Schwab and Fidelity and Vanguard as well. And what happens is these firms go out to banks all around the country, and they go to the banks and they say, hey, tell you what, give us $10 million of your 5-year CD at 2.1%, and we'll offer that to our customer. And oftentimes, because it's a big bulk purchase, the customers of the investment firm can actually get a little better interest rate than what the bank itself is offering, in part because the bank itself gets a bunch of money and does not have to deal with all the paperwork and hassle and headache of establishing what could be literally millions of accounts for this one particular CD. The CDs are still insured, FDIC insured, up to the normal limits, and you are under, if you purchase a standard CD anyway, you're still going to get the interest promised plus your principal at maturity. But there is one very important difference between brokered CDs and the kind that we're used to at our regular banks or credit unions.
What's the important difference?
A loyal listener in Southeast Wisconsin found out already, but the value can fluctuate. With normal CDs, you typically put the money in, and if you pull it out before maturity, you pay a small penalty for early withdrawal, maybe 6 months or a year's worth of interest. With brokered CDs, they are priced on the monthly statement to rise and fall according to the market value of the certificate of deposit. And it's just an estimate by the investment firm that holds the CD as to what that value would be if you were to go ahead and sell it. But you might put in $10,000, and a few months later you might see a CD worth $9,600. You might also see it worth $10,300, depending again on how interest rates go and what the market is for that particular CD.
All right. Do you think, is this a problem?
It can be if you're not familiar with it and you're not comfortable with the notion of putting money into a CD that can technically rise and fall in value. But it's only a problem if you want or need to get the money out before maturity. If you don't need it, you can wait. And if everything goes according to plan, the bank will pay off the CD with the proceeds on the date that you expect it. It's only really when interest rates rise, the value of the CDs then generally will fall. But again, if you just hold it on to maturity, you should still get what you put in on the initial get-go.
So how would you advise people to take advantage of brokered CDs?
They can be very good for a small part of the portfolio, not a majority for most people, and definitely you have to be comfortable with the notion that the value can rise and fall. But in my opinion, they're actually safer than money market accounts, because money market accounts, we have no idea what is in those money market accounts. If it's not FDIC insured, we have no implicit or explicit guarantee of when we're going to get our money back and what we're going to get if problems should arise. If you are going to use brokered CDs, it's usually a good idea to ladder maturities out, meaning you might want to have some coming due in a couple years, some coming due in 4 years or 5 years. And also, you might want to also get some CDs at normal banks and institutions on your own. The rates might not be as good, but those typically have standard surrender penalties of 6 months or a year's worth of interest. CDs, brokered CDs, and CDs at banks and credit unions are definitely better than bond funds from a risk perspective, because bond funds, we have no idea what's inside those bond funds. The values can fluctuate quite a bit. The interest will fluctuate. And we have no idea if we'll get our money back, when we'll get our money back from bond funds. That doesn't make bond funds bad, but it just means that sometimes these kinds of CDs can be a safer alternative than a typical bond fund.
Thank you, loyal listener in Southeast Wisconsin. If you have a question for Kevin that you would like answered, perhaps in a future On Your Money email bag segment, you can email us onyourmoney@wpr.org or call us now at 1-800-642-1234. Kim in Eau Claire is with us first. Hello, Kim. Kim, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for the program. I've got a thrift savings plan. I'm 18 months away from retirement. I'm not to where I was before the first downturn. I had been all in the stock market, and with the way it's been fluctuating lately, I got into the G fund, if you know about that. I'm just wondering if I could stand to be a little bit risky to try to make back where I was in 2008.
Boy, the G Fund is the government securities fund, right, Kim?
Correct.
Okay. That's a tough question, especially on the cusp of retirement and at a time when stock prices, at least in the U.S., are breaking all-time highs. My preference would be is to split some of that money out of the G Fund and into the stock fund. But keep in mind two things. One is that G Fund doesn't pay a whole lot. It hopes to beat inflation, but you're not going to make a whole lot, and there are risks to government securities bond funds out there that that can go down in value as well. So this might be a safer alternative for you. The stock funds, if you're going to put money in that, Kim, you have to be very comfortable and prepared for the idea that it can go down 30 or 40% in a given year, and especially at a time after they've had a big run-up in prices like we've had over the last almost 5.5 years now. So if you're comfortable with that, you say, I'm going to slide, say, $10,000 over, know that within a year, it might be worth $11,000. It could also be worth $6,000. Your retirement is going to last a long time, hopefully, and you're going to need some growth in that money probably. And if you do, a little bit of stock exposure is okay. But I'm not crazy about doing it now, and especially when you're on the cusp of retirement, because you probably have enough to worry about losing this paycheck eventually without having to worry about a significant portion of your assets dropping as well.
Okay, Kim?
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And if you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. When we come back, we will have many more of your calls with your personal finance questions, and we'll talk about how investors are dealing with inflation. That's coming up on Your Money here on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question that you would like to run by Kevin. Barbara in Milwaukee is with us now. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. I love, 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 love the show, and I have increased my financial literacy by listening.
Oh, we love you, Barbara. Thank you.
All right, Barbara, you have the rest of the hour. Talk about anything you want.
I need it. Unfortunately, with the passing of a dear relative, the fortunate part is I will receive an inheritance, and because I've listened to the show through my CPA, I got referrals to a fee-based financial planner to manage that inheritance, and his first recommendation, though, was a commission-based. I asked for a fee-based. He had another name. I visited with both people. They had essentially the same outlook and the same perceptions and did the same troubleshooting on all my situations. And I like both planners. I got the proposal from the fee-based planner. I have no problem with the percentage of the fee, but there's also a substantial upfront planning fee. And I just wanted to know if that's typical.
Good for you. You're doing your due diligence. And I'm happy with the results of what you've received so far. The upfront planning fee, I don't hear about that a lot. I usually, was it several thousand dollars or a few hundred dollars?
It's just $1,000, and okay. I understand that what they're doing, you know, deserves
payment.
Exactly. However, I thought that was part of the reason why you would have the increase in the percentage, which is a difference between about 0.5% versus 1%.
The fee-based planner is charging you 1%?
Correct.
Okay. I've heard of that before. It's not common in my opinion, but it can be done, and sometimes people do it because they're trying to avoid, you know, I don't want to say this, but to use a coarse term, they're trying to use freeloaders, avoid freeloaders, who will just say, hey, I'm going to get this free financial plan and then take it and go. And some places, kind of what's like building a, you know, doing a spec project where they do it and hope the people pay for it. And so I understand that. I think if the financial plan has value to you, the nice thing about it is you now have, if you pay for it, you have the financial plan, and you can judge the merits of the fee-based financial advisor completely on whether or not you want to pay for it. And if like you said, and I think this happens quite often, if the plan were free, they might build the cost of it back into the fee. And if you have a long-term relationship, you might end up paying more in fees than you otherwise would. And 1% is fairly standard on amounts up to maybe, say, $400,000 to $500,000. Typically, the fee should go down there to the point where if you've got over $1 million in assets, it should be quite a bit less than that, depending on the advisor and depending on the types of services offered for it. I'm not crazy about it, but it wouldn't be my reason to not work with that particular fee-based advisor if everything else fell into place.
And I understand with both parties that the fees go down the more that you have invested with them.
Generally.
But frankly, the commission-based person I have a very good rapport with and like their outlook, and they have pointed out to me the very same pitfalls and positive suggestions about ways to go with my investments and tax planning, et cetera, as the fee-based person? And would it make sense to split between the two of them and see how those relationships develop?
Let me ask you a question.
I understand the fiduciary element is involved, but from and I don't know if I can mention the name that this financial planner works with. It's a national group.
Sure. The company actually is in my mind anyway, is relatively irrelevant. I'm much more concerned with the person. And if you have a good relationship with the commission one, you know, here's the good and the bad of the commission one, the upfront commission. They will charge you more upfront, and you will pay less in fees and commissions over time. However, you have to keep in mind that they have a less of a financial incentive to keep you interested and happy in the relationship because they've made the majority of their money up front. It's kind of like if I were a 15-year-old, Barbara, and I came to your house and I said, hey, lady, I'll mow your lawn for the whole summer. Give me $500 right now, and I promise I'll come back every single week and mow the lawn. Most people say, no, I'll hire you to mow the lawn, but I will give you $20 a week or $25 a week or whatever every time you mow the lawn so that you have that incentive for it. And if you aren't happy with the way the kid is mowing the lawn, you have the ability to take the money you were going to pay him and give it to someone else. With the commission-based advisor, you have to have a really solid advisor who understands that he or she has an obligation to help you, even though most of the money he or she has made has already been earned. And if you found that person, that's great. With the fee-based advisor, though, the long-term relationship that most people want is more explicit and upfront.
Okay. Thank you so much again. Just the best advice. And, you know, when I went looking for a financial advisor, I went looking for someone like you, and only because you were not available, I would have traveled from Milwaukee to Madison. I'm quite serious.
Well, thank you, Barbara. That's very kind of you. Who knows what will happen in the future? But, right, yes, as of now, we're not taking new clients. But you never know. That might change.
And we
down
are
the road.
All the poorer for
Well, just keep listening to the radio show. You get most of the advice for none of the cost.
We'll just invest in cloning.
That's so kind, Barbara, and we would give you the rest of the hour, but we do have many other callers here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
For calling, and good luck. And that that's, I think, advice that all of us can use, too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a money matter that you would like to ask Kevin about, our next caller is Dan in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Like, two parts I have. I'll be 70 and a half in next year, and I understand I need to start taking money out of our IRAs at 70 and a half. I don't need the cash flow. What am I best off in putting that money into once I take it out of the IRA and keep the taxes low? And the second question is, I've heard advice that you need to have about 10% of your investments in a liquid form, such as cash or bank account or a checking account. Is there any truth to that? Thank you.
In terms of putting the money in, it's just part of the overall allocation. If you do any charitable giving, Dan, there will be a provision. I think it'll stick again next year, is that IRA owners over the age of 70 and a half, even those who do not itemize, can still donate that RMD to a qualified charity and avoid being taxed on it, even if otherwise they'd have to itemize to get the deduction for it. But otherwise, it should just be part of your own allocation, your overall allocation. And actually, it does touch on your second question, where 10%, I'd actually prefer that you do it by living expenses. I'd like you to have, especially in retirement, at least a year's worth of living expenses set aside in a liquid account that's not going to go up in value, but it's not going to go down as well. And more importantly, you can get at it right away. So that might mean short-term CDs and treasuries. It might mean savings bonds. It might mean CDs that don't have a big penalty to get out. And so if you do not yet have 1 year's worth of living expenses set aside, I would put that distribution just in your checking account or savings account.
Okay, thank you.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you very much, Dan. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. We'll get to more of your calls in just a few moments. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, we'll have some We'll have some tips on what we can do to protect our homes from burglars after Smart Assets. Time now for the Smart Assets segment of the show. Investors are understandably concerned about inflation, but they may be risking too much for a relatively minor problem. So what's the story here, Kevin?
Well, I hear this a lot from people, both clients and people on the show, where they're trying to beat inflation, and they're not being greedy. They're not saying, I want 10 and 20% a year. And they're also not extremely risky investors, but they do feel like they need to beat inflation. And that's about maintaining their purchasing power more than it is about jumping past a certain rate. And with the recent figures on inflation starting to bump up, especially in the consumer price index, it's understandable why people are concerned about it, but they may not need to beat that particular rate, and they may find out that it's actually better to not lose the money, especially if it's something that they're already reached financial independence and they're not comfortable with experiencing substantial losses in a short period of time.
Why do you think it is we misjudge the potential rise in our living expenses?
Well, because a lot of the things that we buy on a regular basis, like groceries and gas, definitely are rising in price. And if you've been to the supermarket or the gas pump, you're a little shocked to say, gosh, I don't remember apples being $1.29 mm-hmm. each. It seems like a lot of money for it. And then the big things that we don't buy as often, but are much larger, scarier expenses, like healthcare costs, paying for higher education expenses for ourselves or a family member, those are also rising as well. And wages generally are not keeping up with those rises, especially in those particular areas of the economy. But those expenditures are still a relatively small portion of what most people spend money on. And even with the healthcare and college issues, they're either unlikely to come to fruition in the future, or they're only temporary. The kids are only in college for a few years at a time, hopefully, and then they get out. General spending does not rise as much. And to give you a good example, that most people, their biggest single expenditure in a month is their mortgage payment. And if you are smart enough to get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, your mortgage payment has not gone up at all since you first took it out.
Yeah, so can you break that down for us, an example of that?
Yeah, sure. Let's say you're spending $5,000 per month right now. And if you look and you say, well, I need to adjust for inflation and my future spending, and so I'm going to figure in a 3% cost of living adjustment every single year. That means that in 15 years, your $5,000 monthly spending would go to $8,000. And when you look around and you see the prices of the stuff we typically buy, it's easy to see how that could happen. But to illustrate how unlikely it is to occur, you can just look backwards and at 15 years ago. And if you discounted your spending amount by 3% per year, you're only spending $3,000 per month 15 years ago. And I would bet most people who are spending $5,000 now would not be spending $3,000 15 years ago, and they are unlikely to be spending $8,000 15 years from now. And usually when people say, well, I am actually spending that amount of money and more on a greater increase, it's because something has changed in their life. They've had kids, the kids have gotten older, they've moved to a different house, they're paying more in taxes because they're making more money, and even if you're spending more money because you have kids or the kids are costing you more, hopefully those kids will grow up eventually and move out of the house. Some families have no proof that that's going to occur, but that's the way things are supposed to work.
So what advice do you give to those who still want to maintain their purchasing power in the future?
You can use our tortoise and the hare example. That's where we have two portfolios, A and B. And over 5 years' time, let's say you do want to make 3% per year, and so you're able to find an investment that pays you 3% per year. And that's the A portfolio. The B portfolio pays you 10% in 4 out of the 5 years. So you make 10% in each one of those 4 out of the 5 years. But in 1 year, you have a 30% loss. Most people looking for growth and trying to beat inflation would take portfolio B, the one with the 10% gains in 4 years and then a 30% loss in a fifth year. But the Portfolio A actually earns 3% a year. Portfolio B earns about 2.8% a year. And that's only if after that 30% drop, you're still brave and comfortable enough to let the money come back for the future 10% per year gains. And so when a lot of people see that example, they say, oh, gosh, I don't know why I'm trying to get these big gains, because one big loss can wipe out all those big gains and more.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Tracy in Madison is with us. Hello, Tracy.
Hi. I'm calling with a similar case as a previous woman had. I inherited a small stock investment, and it's so small that the brokerage firm refused to assist me with considering alternatives and or procedural processing of changing those stocks, and they directed me to the internet to figure it out for myself. I'm brand new to the brokerage. I'm brand new to stocks. I've never had the money to do that. And I also disagreed with the ethics of the company the stocks were in, and I just wanted to change to something that I truly felt good about having the investment in. And I'm wondering, they told me that I had to have a certain quantity of money in order for me to have the privilege of their advice. Mm. And I'm thinking too that all of this is so brand new that I really felt like if we do have any common core, every subject area has some dealings with money and should be included in educating kids about brokerages and about, you know, the fact that there isn't any help out there. You know, I didn't have a clue that I'm not rich enough to get advice. And I'm thinking, shouldn't brokerages be honoring the public with their services in terms of advancing people that have less money rather than just giving the privilege to people who have a large enough amount of money? I'm just
all right, Tracy. Yeah, we so she's feeling kind of put out.
That's unfortunate. And you would hope that they would say, I'm guessing that the money, Tracy, was probably in the brokerage account and it was owned by whomever passed away and left it to you, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and then that brokerage firm probably made money in commissions off of that account over the time. You would hope they would say, well, this is going to be a pain for us to deal with. We may not make any money off of it, but, you know, to honor the obligation of our deceased client, we'll help the beneficiaries and the heirs with it. And that is the right thing to do. It's also something that doesn't happen as often as it should, in part because they're for-profit businesses and their time is limited and they can only serve so many people at so many rates. But you would hope that you'd get the help with that. Can you give me a rough idea of what the dollar amount of the stocks is, Tracy?
Oh, it's just about $20,000,
right. Okay.
Around there.
Okay. Here's what I would do. Are you having trouble trying to figure out like the cost basis of the stocks or the estate settlement, or is it just you kind of want to know what to do with it?
I really am looking more for an investment where I feel the company is not harming the environment and not tramping on human rights. And I'd like to make sure that the money is going towards purposes that are growth purposes for the community rather than for their own profiteering.
Sure. That's understandable. You can do a couple different things. One is that you can contact an organization like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity, and they have kind of a, not a do-it-yourself arm, but it's one where it says we do more of it yourself for a lower cost, and they'll definitely be happy to help you transfer that money from the account that it's currently at and move it over to their accounts and then even sell it there for a relatively low cost, especially compared to what it would cost you if you were to sell it through a full-service brokerage firm. And then many of these companies have a small department or area of mutual funds that are socially responsible investments that you may choose to switch out of and put the money into those. And they have different screenings that they allow you to use to figure out what you do and don't like about a particular fund or a company. But contact them, go online, or they all have toll-free numbers, and just tell them your situation. And I'm sure they'd find somebody who would be happy to help you.
Good luck to you, Tracy. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Kevin is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Madison and Eau Claire. And he joins us every week, or just about every week at this time, with information and advice on your money. Coming up, we will get some advice on how to protect our homes from burglars this summer, and Kevin will have more answers to your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, if you are away from your house during the day or for days at a time, you should think about who's watching your place. And Kevin, why should we be especially concerned about this right now?
It's burglary season in America right now. July and August are the primary months for burglaries. And the primary time for burglaries is between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. Wisconsin generally has a relatively low number of burglaries per capita compared to the rest of the country, but only 16% of those burglaries are actually cleared by arrest. That's the bad news. The good news is that the average amount taken in a reported burglary is about $1,600. Now, if a person wants to get into your home, whether you're there or not, and what other kind of deterrence you have, he or she is going to be able to get in the home with a sledgehammer. But what you want to do is try to make the job of getting into your house as difficult as you possibly can.
Boy, I'm surprised. I guess I shouldn't be so surprised, but that most of the burglaries happen between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. The burglars know we're at work or out and about, and we're not going to typically be around.
They want the path of least resistance. That's right.
Yeah. So where do we start to make it as difficult as possible?
The typical burglar is not some professional hit man or woman educated, you know, in the CIA and M5 or whatever. It's typically a younger male, and it's somebody who wants to get in and get out as quickly as possible. They only want to spend 60 seconds or less getting in, and they only want to get there for 10 or 12 minutes. They want to grab things that are usually small, easily transportable, and easily sellable. So where you start is case your place. Walk around it. Get your evil mind component at work and say, if I were a burglar, where would I find the easy place to get into this? To get into this house, is it a sliding glass door? One of the main points of entry in a burglar is actually the front door, and the burglars just kick the thing in, or it's often left unlocked. And so, check the front door. Make sure that you've got a good deadbolt in there, and you might want to put up those signs and stickers. Those actually do work as a deterrent about that you've got an alarm system, even if you don't actually have one. Mm-hmm. Lock your doors, and then especially if you're going away, you're going to be away for a while. That whole hidden key trick, they all know it's in the little rock or under the planter right by the front door. So try to think of a more creative, less obvious place than that.
Yeah. My goodness. I was almost going to reveal where mine is. I'm not going to do that. That would not be good. So what about when we're on vacation, Kevin?
Try to keep up appearances that you are still at home and actively living at the place. Stop the mail. Stop the newspaper. Make sure your garbage is picked up and make sure that it's brought out as well. If you can develop a partnership with your neighbor so that you'll watch his or her place and he or she can watch yours. Have the lawn mowed. Don't let that go to seed if you don't normally do it. Otherwise, if you do normally let your lawn completely grow for weeks on end and then it is mowed, someone who's been watching the place will be suspicious. So you might want to look at those timers for lights in the house and turn them on and off at different hours. Those things are run about $5. You can just plug them into the outlet, then plug the lamp into that. And you may want to leave a car in the driveway. It makes it look a little bit more lived in. But then also keep in mind that the car then becomes a potential target for break-ins if you're gone. And then finally, do not, in your auto response for your email, do not say, I will be on vacation from July 23rd to August 15th, and all my valuables are in the basement. And then don't post your vacation pictures on social media where everyone can see it. Keep those pictures private if you can. Besides, let's be honest, even your friends and family really don't want to see your vacation pictures.
Too late, Kevin, too late. So what about are investing in a security system?
Now more than ever, that can be a very cost-effective move. Previously, you'd have to spend thousands of dollars and then somewhere from, you know, $30 to $100 a month for monitoring that same system. Now, there are ones that you can buy on Amazon. There's a couple that are around $200 that get very good reviews, and you can get these set up with a system that's about $10 a month to monitor, but you can do it yourself on your cell phone or your smartphone for free, and that's a very good way to go. You can install it usually within a few hours or so. You might have to worry a little bit about false alarms, but having that up there might give you some peace of mind. And check with your provider of your homeowner's insurance, because you may be able to get a discount for having this type of system in place.
And if we do all this, we don't have to worry about it, right?
Absolutely not. You can just, you know, what I do is I actually take all of my money and all of my valuables and I convert it to cash, and then I buy very expensive beachwear and I just wear it with me for the whole vacation. So I protect myself that way.
Sometimes all the deterrent in the world just doesn't, isn't enough.
Nope, that's right. So that's why you have to make sure that you have insurance while you're checking to see if you get a discount. Make sure everything that you do have is covered, and for the amount of the replacement cost. You can definitely hide the valuables, not in the master bedroom. That's where they look first. You can get a safe, but keep in mind, if you can pick up the safe, so can the burglar, and if they can haul it out, they will, and they'll just take their time to crack it. So if you have something that's really important to you, both for sentimental reasons or for financial reasons, you may want to actually rent out a safe deposit box at a bank.
What about a fake box of cereal that you put your diamonds in? Have you seen?
Which that works out really well for me, because I actually keep my cereal in our jewelry box. So
there you go. You don't want to make a mistake there either.
That's right.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Jean in Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Joy. I listen to your show not only on Tuesday, but the rerun on Sunday.
Good for you.
Thank you, Joy.
I get just as much out of it on the rerun. I have two traditional IRAs. One was funded with pre-tax money and one with after-tax money. When I'm required to do my RMDs, can I take it out of the after-tax money so that less of the withdrawal is taxable or not?
Oh, these things are such a drag, as you are about to find out. And for many years, financial pundits suggested these because they said you can put money into a retirement account. You don't get a tax deduction for it now, even if you don't qualify, but the earnings grow tax-deferred. And they didn't bother to tell people how difficult it was going to be to pull these things out. You have to track it every single year. And you have a formula that you have to use where it's basically the basis and account balance times the distribution amount, which is the amount of the distribution that is not subject to tax. And we'll put a link up at onyourmoney.com, Gene, to a better description of that, one that you can print out and just keep in the file so that you have that handy. Let me ask you this. Of the IRAs, can you give me a rough idea of the balances of those accounts?
The pre-tax is probably about $140,000.
Okay. All right.
And the after-tax is about $80,000.
Okay. Good. Well, the good news for it is that you have saved yourselves taxes on the earnings, assuming you have had some earnings, but you are going to have to pay that anymore. And if you want to go to something right now, you can look at IRS Form 8606, and that has the formula on it as well. But again, otherwise, we'll put a link up to the onyourmoney.com site. Since you're such a loyal listener, times two.
Oh, great. Thank you very much, you guys.
Thank you, Jean. If you would like to hear this show again, you can tune in tonight, or you can tune in on Sunday mornings at 7. And our next caller is Luann in Green Bay. Hi, Luann.
Hi. I am getting to the point where I'm being able to select what I want as an annuity for my retirement. And there are about 7 options, but the only ones I'm thinking of, there's a greater sum of money for the rest of my life, slightly reduced for a guaranteed 60 payouts, reduced slightly from that for a guaranteed 180 payouts. And then I do have a husband, and then the next option would be, again, slightly reduced, but for the rest of my life and also for the rest of his life at 75% of what that sum is. He's been self-employed. He has not put anything away. So I'm actually thinking that option number 4 would be better, but considering I'm not you, I'd ask
thank your own personal God for that.
Yes, yes. But I thought I'd ask your advice.
Well, this is an easy question to answer, and all you need to tell me is exactly the dates you and your husband are going to pass away.
Yeah, and... well, actually, we do know that.
Okay.
We've been married for 30 years, and when we first got married, we got some life insurance, and according to the actuary, he will predecease me by 3 months.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, but considering that's not exactly perfect, I was just wondering if,
Yeah, we don't know. What is the...
No, it's very difficult to say that, and because you don't know not only your life expectancy, despite what the actuary says, which, by the way, that guarantees you at least 3 months of happiness left over. No, that's a terrible thing to say.
No, are you kidding? I'll have to pick up all the pieces.
You're right. You only have 3 months to do it. You're right.
And
you have to hurry.
Only 3 months,
yes. You probably, and especially since you do not have other retirement, there are two things to consider. One is that if this is going to be a main source of income for you and your husband in your retirement, you do want as much as you possibly can get, of course. That would lead you to get the higher payment. But the problem, of course, is that when a married couple is looking at a situation like this, and when the first person passes away, in this case, let's say it's your husband, the lesser of your two Social Security checks goes away as well. So you don't want a big drop in the pension as on top of that. So I'm sorry, Lynn, is there an option where you do get 100% guaranteed even to the surviving spouse?
Yes.
Okay.
But his Social Security would be the lesser.
Yep. His is the one that would go away, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, that happens no matter what, no matter who passes away first, the lower Social Security check goes away and the higher one generally stays on. So I would go with that one where it's the 100% to the survivor so that continues. So you'll get a little less money now. Chances are very good that you're going to beat the odds. Wisconsin Public Radio's listeners mm-hmm. generally outlive the people who don't live to Wisconsin Public Radio. I have proof of that. And so you want to take something that is going to pay you a little bit more now but still be there if one of you passes away.
Good luck, Luann. Quickly, Spencer in Barrington, Illinois emails, I'm a 23-year-old college graduate. I would say that financial literacy amongst people my age is quite low. In fact, the only finance class I've ever taken was in high school. They taught us how to write checks and open a bank account, but I know very little concerning the real important aspects of finance. He goes on, but asks, what is a good resource for younger people to learn about the basics of finance?
Okay. For information and for tracking your own situation, mint.com is really good, as is You Need a Budget, YNAB.com. That's more about spending. I would also look at Morningstar.com and then Kiplinger.com and Money.com are all great websites that give lots of information that are geared towards younger people. And we'll put links to those websites up at our website on yourmoney.com later on today.
Excellent. And what is the website of the week?
KnowYourStuff.org. KnowYourStuff.org gives you all kinds of information, how to take a home inventory and make sure that you not only have everything properly insured, but also have record of it so that if you are burgled in the future, you've got a listing of everything that you had and a valuation for it for insurance purposes. KnowYourStuff.org. And we'll have that too up at onyourmoney.com.
Have to check that out. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with us every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.